The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Remember that slow, easy start to Georgia's new political reality, you know, just after New Year's? I can't either. Voting lawsuits, voting system overhaul, fights over MARTA and Gwinnett, Medicaid expansion, and whether the state will take control of the world's busiest airport from the city. Makes you want to work up an appetite for a big political breakfast, and we've got one for you. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Great to have you along with us, and our regulars are back. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, a communications consultant, and former Deputy Chief of Staff to Governor Nathan Deal. And we are delighted to be bringing you this podcast from the 28th Annual Georgia Bar Media and Judiciary Conference in downtown Atlanta at State Bar Headquarters. We have an audience with us. Give yourselves a hand. Thanks so much for being here. And we will be getting to your questions, and those will be part of the podcast. You never know, so get your radio voices ready. All right, let's start with voting. Theron, I'll start with you. We had a committee pass out the big new voting reform bill. The preferred new voting system for the committee and a lot of Republican leaders is one in which, yes, there is a paper trail, but it comes out at the back end. The voter would indicate his or her choice on the front end on a machine. A lot of voting rights advocates and Democrats preferred a hand paper ballot that was then counted electronically. But does it really matter? In a sense. I mean, if the verification systems are there, if Democrats get more of what they want from some of the other provisions in this bill, does it matter?
Well, one of the things that we know happened, Dennis, in this last election is that whether it was on the state or local levels, there were some voter irregularities and some voter problems. We do know that there were some challenges with our absentee ballot procedures because we saw an influx of absentee ballot applications and also how absentee ballots, some were counted properly, some were not counted properly. I think what you have seen is that the AJC has done a poll that shows that the majority of people in the state of Georgia prefer a electronic voting option with a paper receipt. But this is not new news that Democrats went a step further in the very first commission meeting and sort of made the case of why they felt that a paper ballot counted and then with a paper receipt would be another option on the table. But here's what I want to try to do, Dennis. Let's just take the partisanship out of it. Let's just take Democrat and Republican out of it. What I know that every Georgian and every American want is three things. One, you want to make sure that the election process is fair. Two, you want to make sure that your vote is secure. And what Democrats and Republicans at the state legislature have got to do is not only make sure that the votes are secure, but the Georgians who vote have got to feel that their votes are secure. And so I think therein lies the challenge that in this sort of post-election that we've seen from Stacey Abrams' group with Fair Fight and others who have joined her is making sure that we attack these voter problems and these voter irregularities and work with the new Secretary of State to prevent them from happening again.
This is multi-layered in many ways, and I think for public consumption, it's oversimplified. And the most messaging that you hear on this is from Democrats, particularly Stacey Abrams, saying that this is voter suppression. And I think she's putting a lot of technical things under the banner of voter suppression, which suggests that a certain group is being singled out and their votes are less likely to count, or somehow they are less likely to be allowed to vote, et cetera. And that's a really divisive way of going about it. And I think let's look at what we have. We have a 17-year-old system. So we have one of the oldest voting machines that are used anywhere in the country. We are due for an update, period. And I think for the most part, we haven't had a lot of systemic problems when you consider what a fractured system we have. It's amazing that it's worked as well as it has. You look at what happened last year, any problem that happened anywhere in the state when it came to voting, people said, oh, Brian Kemp suppressing votes. Well, in Georgia, it's very decentralized and local. These are local county boards of election that are making these decisions. And look at what made news last year, talking about Gwinnett County and their standards for what absentee ballots should be counted. It was a much stricter standard, and they ended up not allowing a lot more votes than other counties. But that's a local decision. It's not something being made in the Secretary of State's office when it was Kemp or now.
But wasn't one of the arguments from Stacey Abrams has been, look, the buck stops with the state.
It does to a degree. But again, he's sort of an administrative role there. The buck really does stop on the local level. It made national news last year when Randolph County, which before last year, 98% of Georgians had never heard of. They would have been surprised to learn that there was a Randolph County, Georgia. They closed 7 of 9 precincts. I believe I'm right. It's a majority-minority county. And so the national storyline was, look at what Georgia's doing. They're closing down precincts for minority voters to suppress the vote. This is probably a systemic effort. Well, when you dug just a tiny bit, I mean, just barely scratched the surface, you discover that was done by the local board of elections, which is run by Democrats, which is run by the majority population of the county, which is minority. And many of those precincts that were closed were the precincts that Trump won in that county in 2016. So whose vote is being suppressed there? But it was happening all over the place, and they're being made locally.
One of the things that Brian left out is that as we sit here right now in the state of Georgia, there's a open and active investigation into voter fraud in this state. So this whole notion that voter suppression was just something that in 2019 that Stacey Abrams and National Democrats just decided to start focusing on is not true. I love when Brian, you know, goes to Randolph County. If you remember Randolph County when it came up, it only got really amplified on a national level because then candidate Kemp, who is now Governor Kemp, who I've been very, very fair to. I want to make sure.
I agree, you have.
Okay. But he escalated it, and he said that there were people, he didn't say the names, but there were folks out here in these organizations that were not registering these voters properly, that basically sort of inferred that these African-American voters who were being registered were not being registered properly. So to me, he sort of inferred that the problem was not that they were closing down these precincts because of funding, but these folks were basically being misled by these groups. And so then in this climate, Brian, that President Trump has been the architect of, then you saw the national media sort of pounce on it. The second thing I want to point out is this. Notice I didn't use the term voter suppression, because if it's one term that gets Brian more excited than anything, and I've learned now in our third podcast that I never used the term voter suppression. But let's not act like that there are attempts that when you are the Secretary of State and you are a local election board person, you can put in certain laws, create certain laws, create certain parameters that infers the attempt to want to suppress the vote.
So let's take a look at this bill then. There are some other provisions aside from the one that's getting all the attention. Which machine do we pick? There are, for instance, provisions, Theron, that require more notification, more outreach to voters who might have their registrations in trouble because their signatures didn't match or because they hadn't voted in a while. Is that an effort, do you think, that will get things going across party lines and relieve some of these concerns that have undermined trust in the system?
This bill also, Dennis, I think has language in it that says that it want to put a time sort of period, reduce the time period that one can register to vote before a common election. Let me just really attack this at the heart. This is not really a partisan discussion. Of course, I want more Democrats to be able to register and vote because I want them to win. Brian wants more Republicans, particularly the white older man who we know is the backbone of the Republican Party, to be able to...
I aspire to be one
yeah.
day.
Yeah, you want to... Yes. He aspires to be this older white male That's who is the backbone of the Republican Party. So
I'm already there.
Yeah, so we want people to register to vote. But let's go into the heart of this, Dennis. It's really about what Mitch McConnell said. Mitch McConnell was recently in an article, and he basically said that he's against the country becoming browner, more people of color, because the browning of America, the more minority voters we get, they're going to register to vote, and they're not going to vote for Republicans. And so the underlying issue here is it's got to be a bill that's fair and proper all the way across the line, and it does not look like it has the intent to make it harder for people who are not as middle class and upper class as some of Brian and his friends on the Republican side, but people who look like me and folks that actually are working class Georgians have the opportunity to provide the necessary identification to register to vote and then have their vote counted properly.
Their votes are counted properly, and that's why Stacey Abrams almost won this thing. It was super tight. And, you know, and I think that we do the democracy a disservice when we undermine faith in our electoral systems. And I think that by racializing so much of this voter stuff, by implying that certain racial groups are treated differently by the system, when you can't back that up with a lot of statistical data. Look, in Georgia, and just to go to the two major voter groups, white Georgians and African-American Georgians, they are registered to vote and at equal levels as far as their percentage of the population, and they turn out to vote at equal levels as percentages of the population. And I don't know why we keep telling them, hey, your votes didn't count. Well, they did.
And for those of us who are listening to the podcast, there was a panel here at the Bar Media Conference right before us where there were at least anecdotal stories from folks who monitored voter complaints, who received voter complaints, who said that they were getting them disproportionately from minority voters.
And Brian, I'm not racializing it. The facts are the facts.
You did. Like, Mitch McConnell didn't say he was upset with the browning of America. You have to show me that quote.
I'll send it to you.
You'll have it before
we get off this. Mitch McConnell did not see that. Brian, we talked about it.
That would be huge news if he said, I don't like the browning of America.
He said that the country is becoming browner and browner, and basically it's becoming more minority. And
Which is true,
that they are more likely to vote Democrat than to be Republican.
That's true as well. If he pointed out those facts, okay, that's true.
Brian, let's not.
But that's different than saying he doesn't like the browning of America because he's bad for Republicans.
Let's not spend 80% of time talking about vote suppression because, you know, I don't like talking about it that much.
I don't know.
This is what I'm going to say. All I want you to do is to basically make sure the people in your party share your same sentiment. So it's not about race, it's about making sure that the laws are fair and that the votes are secure.
I wanted to get to a point that Brian raised, and this is about the lawsuit from Fair Fight Action, founded and chaired by Stacey Abrams. Brian, the problem is, from the point of view of Fair Fight, look, yeah, we don't want to undermine trust in the system, but if there are issues that we in good faith feel need to be addressed, the courts are the place to do it. And so there's that catch-22 of it undermines faith in the system if, according to Fair Fight, people can't vote when they should. Yes, it runs the risk of undermining faith in the system if there are just lawsuits. So aren't they using the tools that the Constitution gives them?
Sure. Yeah, I have no problem with there being lawsuits. I have no problem with there being a search for legislative remedies if we find a problem. I have no problem with acknowledging that throughout our history, we have to continually update with new technology and new facts and new data how we administer our election system. And if something is found that we need to change, I'm all for it. What I don't like is, in a very broad strokes, sending the message not only to Georgians but to the rest of the country that we have a broken, corrupt, oppressive system here because there's no data to support that. That's my problem.
So, Theron, how much pressure is there on Democratic lawmakers now to, on the one hand, work across the aisle so that you come up with something that everybody, if they're not thrilled with, can at least trust, and on the other hand, address the concerns of the grassroots voting rights advocates who say we still have something wrong here?
You know, you go back to what happened right after the election, is that you saw Democratic members in the state House and the state Senate coming together to be on this commission, and there was a huge push for the paper ballots and the paper receipts because that's how you go, that's how you negotiate. I mean, that you can't start right in the middle and then try to go left. I mean, you have to basically put a stake in the ground, and I think that a lot of Democrats were looking at the data, and they also were looking at the mood from the people in their districts. But ultimately, I believe that the Democrats are going to be able to work with the Republicans to make sure that, again, voters feel that their elections are going to be fair and that their votes are secure.
Let's pivot just a moment and talk about one of the people who will be key to all of this, who now has an interesting situation of his own within his own ranks, House Speaker David Ralston. And there has been at least a move to introduce a resolution calling for his resignation. It came from within the Republican Party. The question here is, and Brian, I'll start with you.
Are we,
yeah.
Yay.
Why?
Yeah.
Yes.
Does somebody introduce a resolution like that on his or her own? Or, you know, from a political strategy point of view, is there something else going on?
You're talking about the resolution to make him resign? Mm-hmm. If that's being done by a very young representative, somebody who's still kind of getting his feet under him.
Representative Clark.
Clark from Buford.
And he's somebody who's potentially exploring the 7th congressional district race now that Congressman Rob Woodall is stepping down. And I think he sees this as a chance to raise his profile as a way of signaling to the really conservative elements of the Republican base and making a name for himself with those constituencies. At this juncture, he better run for the 7th congressional district because he's never going to get a bill passed again. You know, he's not going to have very good committee assignments, I would imagine,
or office assignments. He might have to take the train just to get in.
it's certainly an act that ends your career in the General Assembly. You know, if you're going to shoot at the king, you better shoot him. Or get out, you know. So it's a bold move in that way. But I think it's particularly interesting that the Democrats in the House have held their fire and have actually been very civil and complimentary of the Speaker. And it goes to show you how he has governed the House. Yesterday when we were taping, Theron mentioned what Speaker did to back up Democratic Representative Scott Holcomb on the rape kit law 2 years ago when that got done in a bipartisan fashion. And the Speaker stands with the Democrats in the House when he thinks that they're right. He's an institutionalist in many ways more than a partisan. And he is a partisan. He's a conservative Republican. But he looks out for the Democrats in the House. And you're seeing the respect he has shown them reflected back on him during this time of tumult. And I think we're all better off for having his leadership, particularly now where you've got all new leadership in the Senate. You've got a completely new administration with young, fresh faces in there, and a lot of the old hands who have been running the state for 8 years, you know, left on January 14th. So it's a time of chaos and a time of unsteady transition. And Ralston is hugely important to guiding the ship forward through this session. So I was glad to see him come out last night, and he was on the news, and he defended himself, and if I was going to criticize it in any way, it would be, I'm a communicator. When this would happen in Governor Deal's office, I would trot up the little spiral staircase into his office, and I'm being like, let's go fight. Let's go fight. We need a message, and let's go out there because nobody can tell our story better than us. Let's go do it. And I wish they had done that last week. Immediately come out there with a good story.
They mean the speaker's team.
The speaker, yeah.
Let me quickly turn to Theron because I'm watching with Hawk here for just a second. Isn't there a legitimate debate to be had about the legislative leave policy that the Speaker has invoked, and is it not happening because of the position that the Speaker holds at the Capitol? In other words, if this were a rank-and-file lawmaker doing this, would the reaction have been as quiet among lawmakers, lobbyists, other folks who need to get things done at the Capitol?
Well, the one thing that I want to clear up is that the legislative leave policy is not just something that's there for Speaker Ralston.
No,
you're not saying this, yep. But I know most folks who listen to us doesn't know that, Dennis. Yep. So if you're an attorney right now in the legislative session, he or she has the ability to exercise this policy. Now, let's get into the sort of the core of this issue. Speaker Ralston is a part-time legislator, but it's really a full-time job that goes beyond most times when the session ends in April. And so he is busy, especially in election years, trying to raise money for his caucus members to either get elected or reelected. The second thing is that, you know, I was at the Capitol for a whole week and no one was talking about it. Like, us as lobbyists, you know, we didn't talk about it because, one, it was sort of a slow bill. But if you really look at the attacks that's really being sort of applied to the speaker, it's been from the radical right. The reason no one has really come out until Representative Clark against the speaker is because he was one of the few Republicans that you could actually, you know, work with to get things done. And so now you have this resolution for his removal. You've seen former Governor Deal. Mm-hmm. You've seen former Governor Roy Barnes. You've even seen the current governor, Kemp, come out and basically say, we want to work with this guy. But herein lies the challenge that I think the Speaker's office, and he has a great chief of staff, a gentleman named Spiro, who I think are looking at this. This is a 1903 or 05
law
that's been in law in Georgia for over 100 years. And so now you're going to see another legislator, he or she, hopefully from the Democratic Party, maybe step up and show some leadership and say, hey, let's not attack the speaker. You know, he'll come out and defend himself. He'll talk about these continuances and how many of those cases he's actually settled or some of them that are ongoing. But, hey, let's really look at this law and make sure that attorneys, who we need more attorneys at the legislature. I can't tell you how many times that I'm talking to my clients and we are looking for attorneys who really, you know, understand the law. And so I think the speaker will survive this. But I do know that his staff knows that this is something that caught legs and that they responded adequately to it. And I think that you'll see some legislators come together, maybe in the Senate or the House, to really figure out revisiting this law to make sure that it continues to be fair to lawyers. Because what we don't want is that we don't want lawyers to be turned off by being able to do their jobs that actually provide for their family as well. But we want to make sure that they understand how to use the policy effectively.
Yeah, and I would say numerous attorneys at the General Assembly do this. And it's not, I think there was probably a shudder of fear that went through those ranks when these stories came out, because Ralston's not the only person who has to operate a law firm while also being a legislator. Non-lawyers at the General Assembly think that there should be some reforms to this, that it should be reined in to some degree. And lawyers don't think it should be changed because, you know, they say without these protections for our law firms, our ability to earn a living for ourselves, there will be no attorneys in the General Assembly anymore. Today, there aren't enough lawyers to fill the Judiciary Committee in the Senate.
One of our audience members says 14 attorneys. Is that in the Senate or in the legislature as a whole?
House.
In the House. 14 yeah. lawyers in the House.
Out of 180.
180.
Yeah, so you can see it does make a difference. And look, one thing I always talk about is being in the General Assembly is like a vow of poverty in many ways. You know, it takes you away from your business. It pays you very little. It is a sacrifice.
And we will be back with more of The Political Breakfast. Stay right here.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we are back with the Political Breakfast podcast. Great to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare, joined by Republican strategist Brian Robinson, Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, and a great audience at the 28th Annual Georgia Bar Media and Judiciary Conference in downtown Atlanta. And we are going to get to questions from the audience in just a moment. But one other area I want to pick up, and it has to do with the legislature again. Seems to be the because we're in the middle of the session, the busy time. Brian, Governor Kemp has been put in an interesting position almost immediately upon taking office because folks in the GOP, some of them anyway, have put forward a bill, I believe it was Burt Jones, who said state authority should take over the running of Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport from the city. The governor has walked a tightrope on this so far. Any clue as to which way he's leaning? Because that would be, if not decisive, certainly influential.
I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure put on him by people in the business community in Atlanta, as well as
Ed Bastian.
In addition to the city of Atlanta,
Delta has already said this is a bad idea.
So you're talking about one, the state's largest employer, which is Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson, and Georgia's largest private employer, which is Delta, both of which being staunchly opposed to this. It's just like I say to Republicans when we're talking about the religious freedoms bill. Do we have a problem? Hey, and if we don't have a problem, why are we doing something? And what we have is the crown jewel of airports in this country. Now, I do get frustrated by how long the TSA lines are there and how long it takes to get to your gate. But we still, one of the best run airports in the world. And you don't fix what ain't broke. And as a Republican, I am a firm believer that people or groups that put their name on the line and take a risk and make an investment should reap the rewards of that investment and that risk. And I think if you fail, you should own the failure and you should go bankrupt. But if you succeed, you shouldn't have a government come in and take it from you.
So, since this is an idea that is not new, it's been floated for decades, as some folks in our audience can tell you, where is the momentum coming from this time?
I do think that there is the sense that there's a problem with how airport contracts are handed out, and in all honesty, that we all know that.
But that was true decades ago, too.
Well, it's true in almost any giant government operation. But these are very high profile. Those contracts are highly lucrative. I am convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that Theron has the Popeyes contract at the airport, and that's how he's afforded his lifestyle.
And these nice suits I wear.
All these nice suits, yeah. And it is lucrative. It does require oversight. There have been problems. And I do think that that's what kind of gives people the excuse to kind of go in and do it. But if that's the issue, I think we need to attack that issue very acutely as opposed to doing a takeover. I'm just very leery of government takeovers.
I think that as we sort of see this evolve, Dennis, you asked where is it coming from? And I think it's three things. There are billions of dollars in operations and contracts that basically people have the legal and ethical pathway to bid on. So that's the first thing. So I think that people want to try to, quote unquote, level the playing field. I think the second motivation you see is that you have a new mayor who has come out in a very direct but sort of in a very unique leadership style where she has not got into a public battle about the airport. What she has done very effectively is sort of laid out the financial burden and the financial commitments that the city makes, along with the assurance that you have to comply with the FAA. And also, yes, the state has given money to the airport, but the state is going to give money to the airport regardless, and that money has been used effectively.
Does the momentum, speaking of the mayor, come partly from the fact that she does not have the same kind of legislative experience at the Capitol that Mayor Reed did before? He had long-standing relationships with Speaker Ralston. He cultivated a relationship with Governor Deal, and that, in a way, shielded the airport in the past from efforts by some in the state legislature to get this going. Mayor Bottoms doesn't come from the legislature. She doesn't have the history of those relationships.
No, I think that's not the issue. And, you know, I have the unique ability to know both mayors very well. Mm-hmm. I ran Kasim Reed's campaign in 2009. I walked over to the Capitol with him in 2010 when we had our first legislative session. You may remember.
I remember that. I was there.
Governor Deal didn't come into office until 2011.
Yep.
We met with Governor Deal and others in the Senate. and while he was in the House of Representatives. So this notion that this is happening because this mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, is not a former legislator, and I know you're not saying this, it's a good question, but I want to push back on it. It's not because she's not a former legislator. It's not because she may be an African-American woman. It's not because that we have an ongoing federal investigation right now. I mean, let's not leave that out, right? It is because this senator and others did this while Deal was governor, and it just didn't get the legs. And he has done it now, I think, upwards to maybe 2 to 3 times. He finally got it to a point where people on the committee, and I guess he's got some sponsors now, to say, okay, let's just look at this. And so I think that it will not happen. I want to go on the record for saying that. The state is not going to take over the Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. Manager Jackson, before he passed away, said that one of the top priorities, if not the most top priorities, of a mayor is to protect the airport. So this mayor, who I know personally, who I think is going to go down in history as being one of the best mayors that Atlanta's ever had, is totally committed to making sure that doesn't happen.
And real quickly, Brian, that brings up the question of Governor Kemp. He's walked a fine line so far. We'll just have to get a quick yes or no. Does he eventually take a position this session, and what do you think that position will be?
Well, if it passes, he has no choice but to take a position.
Right.
It's going to come to his desk.
But does he get involved in the process?
We'll see. And we don't really know yet where he's going to come down on that. And I gave my opinion on it. I don't think we have a problem, and I think that the city owns it and they should be able to keep it. The argument, just to play devil's advocate, the argument for doing it is this is not a facility of city interest or even regional interest. This is a facility that's important to the economy of the entire state. The city is a subsection of the state constitutionally, so the city is part of the state already. And we're able to use other state facilities like the port, which would sort of be the new structure for the airport the state took over. There's the state ports authority that runs the Brunswick and Savannah mm-hmm. ports. And, of course, that's hugely important to Atlanta's economy, but, you know, all across the state. So the idea is that Hartsfield kind of belongs to all of us, and it's important to all of us, and therefore it should be governed by all of us. And I think that that's an argument that's worth listening to. It's not where I fall down on it, though.
We've got some microphones out there. Your turn to be involved in the podcast with your questions.
I want to ask a question that's not controversial and is nonpartisan. I have been a lawyer for 43 years in this state. It's been a privilege. And I've worked on voter registration for many years. We have about 100,000 Georgians who are going to be graduating high school this year, and about 3 million or more around the country. I do not understand, and I'm hoping one of you geniuses up there can explain why when kids go to get their high school diploma in a couple of months, why they have not already registered to vote. When it's so easy to register to vote, you could do it in 3 or 4 minutes online with the Secretary of State's website. And I've been pulling my hair out trying to figure out why so many, they don't do it. This has nothing to do with voter registration. It has nothing to do with Republican or Democrat. It's just doing the right thing. And generally, people who vote when they're young tend to vote the rest of their lives, and I don't understand it.
Quick theories from either of you?
I agree with you, sir. I think that I had the opportunity to spend some time with the Secretary of State in California, and what the Secretary shared with me is that if you look at the laws in California, I mean, it's probably, I think, the gold standard. I mean, I think you can register to vote immediately online when you move there. I think they have 18-year-old registered voter, but I agree with you. I think that that's something that the new Secretary of State, Raffensperger, I don't know him that well, probably Brian does, but that would be something that I would introduce to sort of temper down a lot of the conversations about voter suppression. And, you know, one of the things that Republicans like to try to give, and they do a really good job of this, in giving Brian Kemp, who I think deserves it, the opportunity to make it easier for people to register to vote. And so I think we should do it. I think that's something that the Secretary of State should commit to doing by the end of his first term.
Yeah, you know, I think young people have always been less likely to show up to vote just traditionally. I think this may be a particularly bad time for it because politics is just so toxic that they just want nothing to do with it. And I just think a lot of people have just, like, forget it. a pox on both your houses. That's what it's got to be.
Let me give you a quick theory, and it's because most high school students, because you asked about high school, most high school students are under 18. And so the idea of registering voters doesn't occur as easily. I've seen voter registration drives for decades at colleges. But I think you raise a really good point. We don't think about high school kids as much because most of them are under 18, but not all of them.
But you know, yes, they're tech savvy. All you have to do, there's Secretary Kemp, he developed an app. You can go onto that app, become a registered voter. It's the easiest thing in the world. They understand it much better than I do. There's no excuse to not being registered. Every American should be registered.
But it's education, too. It's raising awareness. Yes, sir.
Yes, thanks, guys. This is great. So we seem to read with some regularity stories about friends and family of powerful politicians getting jobs and favors. The most recent story this morning about Governor Deal's daughter getting a job with the lottery in what has to be record time. And my question is, what do you think these kinds of things do for public trust in government?
Well, let me go first on that because Brian has got to be careful. I can kind of not be as careful. So I do Georgia Gang on Sunday mornings at 8:30. We tape at 10:30. I probably shocked a lot of people because I came to the defense of Kerry. Only because the guy who usually sits to my left is a person, Phil Kent, who criticizes Democrats. I mean, he spent weeks talking about the Kwanzaa Hall situation, right? I mean, just every week I had to come. And then, oh my God, don't let a mayor or a person from DeKalb County or something do like this that Governor Deal did. So I defended Kerry because I believe what Chris Riley said, the former chief of staff to the governor. He had a good quote. He said, look, there were job openings. They asked for people who were qualified. She applied, and she got the job. So I hope that they realize that in this climate, if she is not qualified, like if she does not meet all of the qualifications for this 100K-plus job, then this is going to be an ongoing story that I'm sure the AJC is going to continue to drive up your digital buys and all your newspaper subscribers. So I think that I hope that they took the necessary steps to make sure that Kerry, who I don't know as well as Brian, will get this job and can go on and make a living for her family.
But should we have, whether it's this case or others, stronger ethics laws dealing with things like nepotism or whatever you want to call it, and especially since the head of the state ethics board or ethics commission just had to resign amid big problems of his own, do we even have the guidance and enforcement to pull that kind of thing off?
But Dennis, as we sit here, the daughter of the president of the United States, who was in Atlanta recently, by the way, Brian, I don't know if you were there to greet her at the airport when she came in. Works for the president.
You weren't invited, Brian?
I wasn't invited to that.
Yeah. So I agree with you, Dennis. But if you do that for this president, I just think that it will probably never happen, Dennis, because, again, I hope that former Governor Deal and Kerry make sure that in this climate that she met all the qualifications. And if she does, she should be able to do the job.
Pass.
But if it was Kasim Reed, if it was Keisha Lance Bottoms, if it was Theron Johnson, if it was Michael Thurman, if it was Eldron Bell, oh my God, Republicans, everybody will be saying this is nepotism, this is cronyism. But I am support of Kerry getting the job.
Thanks for the question, Ken. In all seriousness, I've been on the front row of this for 9 years. And I hear you, and I get it, and I understand the public perception. Just like with voting reforms, I'm open to suggestions on better ways to do it so that there's more public trust and transparency. But we do have transparency. It was in your paper this week. The public knows.
By the way, the questioner was a reporter for the AJC, just to clarify for
yes.
our listening audience.
Yes, the great Ken Foskett.
Great Ken Foskett.
So there is some transparency there, and people can have their own opinion about whether or not a $100,000 a year job is appropriate in this scenario. I want to tell you the other side of the family. When I started with him, Kerry, who got this job, the one who's in your paper, she and her husband, they had owned a store in Habersham County that had gone under, just like many, many businesses did in 2008 and 2009. This happened to many Americans. Sandra and Nathan Deal were the co-signers of the loan. And when their daughter and son-in-law went bankrupt, the deals were on the hook for millions of dollars. And so for 8 months of that year, we had to deal day in and day out with stories, particularly in the AJC, that Carrie and her husband had to deal with stories that were very public about their financial situation, their bankruptcy. They aren't public figures in their own right, but their dirty laundry was strewn across the state literally every day. I saw Nathan Deal in tears over and over again because of what was happening to his daughter through no fault of her own, because he was running for governor, because he was a public figure. I saw the very personal pain that he felt. And when he won, one of the first things he did was bring in the then editor of the AJC and deputy managing editor of the AJC and said, if you ever touch my family again, you will never see the inside of the governor's office for the next 8 years. And we managed through that relationship. But the families of politicians may get, every once in a while, they're on the bubble of getting into Georgia Tech or UGA. They may, you know, get pushed up and get that acceptance where the average Joe, like I was, wouldn't have. And maybe every once in a while they get open, they get pushed to the front of the line for a job. Absolutely. I'm sure that happens. But let me tell you, the kids of politicians often hate being kids of politicians because the spotlight that is put on you is not of your own doing. So I just want to give that other side of it. I understand the public trust issue, absolutely. But I've also seen families really, really hurt by trying to be public servants.
Hi. I know, Mr. Robinson, you said that there need to be more attorneys in the legislature. Yet,
did I say that? Is that what I did?
I thought you said and yet in the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Zara Karinchak and Senator Jen Jordan were left off the Judiciary Committee. So can you address that?
Well, Senator Jordan was actually made a chairman of the other the smaller Judiciary Committee.
She raised the point that the committee over which Jen Jordan, who's a Democrat from Cobb County, over which she's been appointed to preside, in the opinion of the person who raised the question, doesn't have much jurisdiction. That's for our listeners. Go ahead.
Okay. One, Jen Jordan, who actually is a friend of mine and a very, very smart senator and highly capable and a rising star in Democratic politics, in my opinion, asked for one committee chairmanship. One. They all get to fill out a sheet. She asked for one. She got it. As far as whether or not that committee has power, that has to do with what decisions the lieutenant governor makes on where he sends those bills. And I think he made a point after, you know, Senator Jordan asked for that committee and then you know, tweeted out that she was so happy to be on that committee. And then the next day held a news conference saying what a crappy committee it was.
Well, Senator Jordan thought she was going to be appointed to a committee that had power and then was very happy to get that appointment and then only later found out, in fact, it was a non-committee that would not have jurisdiction over anything major.
Now,
that is what she said.
That is what she said. You're absolutely right. And here's the thing. Jen Jordan's really smart, and she didn't show up in the Senate for the first time in January. She was there last year. She knows how the committees work. She got what she asked for. And as far as jurisdiction goes, it's got to do with what bills are sent there by the lieutenant governor. And the lieutenant governor, after they did that news conference, has made a point of sending bills to that committee for her to work on. I think she's highly capable. But this idea that they didn't let a bunch of Democrats become committee chairman is just absolutely inane. There's no legislative body.
Let me help
my friend. Okay, guys, we're really short on time here.
Republicans control the majority. They pick who goes what. And that's how it works in every legislative body in America.
Let Theron weigh in here.
No, I'm okay. Look, I think, listen.
A moderator's work is not as easy as
you
think.
I think I said we need more lawyers in the legislature, right? I'm not a lawyer, but I've worked at two international law firms and been around a lot of smart lawyers. The case with Jen, who I helped get elected, who's a friend as well, you know, I kind of come down the middle on this because that's why elections have consequences. Had we elected Sarah Riggs Amico, we wouldn't even be having this conversation, right? You would have probably had. So that's why I would take it back on Democrats. We got to get out and vote a little bit more next time, and we got to vote a little bit more.
Not more often, right?
No, I said. But I do think that with the situation with Senator Jordan, it discourages people, not just women, not just lawyers, for really wanting to work hard every day to try to pass bills, to work in a bipartisan manner, to be afforded the right of the lieutenant governor to pick or choose who he wants to serve in these committees. And so the Republican Party, I would tell you, though, if you look at how they've treated Senator Edelman, who is one of two Republican women in the Senate, I would tell you, Brian has done a good job of talking about how if Republicans are going to continue to win in this state, they've got to have a message for suburban women. And treating Senator Renee Utterman the way that they treated her is not a good first step to winning back the suburban vote.
And that's it for this edition of The Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Republican strategist Brian Robinson is a communications consultant and former deputy chief of staff to Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is a public affairs and government consultant and former National Southern Regional Director of the Obama 2012 campaign. Thanks to both of you.
No airport takeover.
I'm fine with that. Yeah.
And that clapping you hear is from our wonderful audience who've been with us all through this at the 28th Annual Georgia Bar Media and Judiciary Conference in downtown Atlanta. Thanks to the First Amendment Foundation and to the State Bar. And thank you guys for being with us. Give yourselves a hand.
All right. Thank y'all.
And if you like this show, subscribe. That is a great way for other people to find us, because if you rate us, that helps even more. We really appreciate it. We'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.